And I, please, hear ye, the Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session for the court.
Have you please be seated. Good morning and welcome to this session of the Idaho Supreme Court here in Portland, Idaho. For the court this hour is Jones versus Lynch, an appeal brought by Sasha Dales and Brandy Jones. They will be represented here today by Monica Brennan. Good morning.
Yes, ma'am.
And Ms. Brennan is accompanied by Leander Jones, who's appearing only today. Good morning, sir. The respondent, Tracy Lynn, is represented here by Daniel Stowe. Good morning, Mr. Stowe.
Good morning.
The note of Justice Jody is not with us this morning. She's excused from this hearing, but she will review the recording of the proceeding and participate fully in the decision. Counsel, do either of you have anything preliminary to your argument today?
No.
If not, Ms. Brennan, would you share with us how much time you've reserved for rebuttal?
My intention is to have my opening be 20 minutes and my rebuttal be 10 minutes.
Thank you.
But there was kind of
some
questions.
I understand that. We just like to sort of have a way of keeping track of where we are at, even though we see the colors. Let's go with you just on the count. With that, thank you very much. You may proceed then.
Good morning, Your Honors. To start out with, I'd just like to talk a little bit about my clients. My clients are the mother and sister of Reginald Justice Knight, who unfortunately drowned in Lake Coeur d'Alene approximately 6 years ago. Mr. Reggie Knight, I'm going to call him Reggie for the purposes of today, was boating with two other underage boys. He was 16 years old, and the other boys were also 16 years old. They were all in high school. The other two boys were named Cameron and Brody for the purposes of today's argument. I will call them Cameron and Brody. Cameron was the owner and operator of the boat, and Brody was what we're, for purposes of today, going to call the spotter. He was a passenger in the boat that would have been spotting if someone were to leave the vessel, intentionally or unintentionally. The boys were out supposed to be having fun that day. They had taken the boat in the morning and driven down to Shooters, which is a bar restaurant on the lake that you can dock at the dock there and then go in and have lunch. The three, in their testimony, stated in their depositions that they had a couple of beers while they were driving down the lake, and I say down the lake because they were going south from Coeur d'Alene, and that they had been drinking a little bit when they were on their way down. That testimony is in the record. They stopped to have lunch where they came across Tracy Lynn, and she was with a gentleman named Dale Atkinson, who has since passed away. They were speaking with Dale and Tracy while they were at the restaurant. Tracy knew them, who's the defendant herein, and or the appellee. She knew them because she had a minor son who was also in high school, and so that's how she knew the boys. So she knew they were minors, and she knew that they were in high school, and she knew all three of the boys. And the evidence was that the boys asked Shooters Bar to buy them an alcoholic drink, or that they could buy an alcoholic drink from the server there, and the server said, no, you cannot have an alcoholic drink. So apparently they requested that Tracy Lynn purchase an alcoholic drink for them at the bar. The boys, after eating, went down and were on their boat, and they were standing on the boat. Tracy Lynn purchased a large alcoholic drink with 12 shots in it, called ironically a shooter sinker, because the joke is supposed to be that after you drink that, you might sink to the bottom of the lake, which is exactly what happened in this case. It's also known as a derailer because there's another restaurant that sells a similar type of drink in Coeur d'Alene, and that it causes the train to go off the track, essentially, because there's so much alcohol in there. So these are young, inexperienced drinkers, and Tracy put the alcohol into a bag, a brown paper bag, brought it down to the dock, delivered it to them on the dock. All boys went out into the middle of the lake, drank the shooter sinker. All three were likely impaired, and while the boat was progressing up the lake, Reggie got on the back of the boat. Ironically, he was being Snapchat videoed, which is where you can videotape and send it to a bunch of people, so a lot of people saw the Snapchat. He got up kind of on the back, according to some of the witnesses, there was varying testimony. He got up on the back pad there and started dancing and either jumped and or fell off the back while he was being videotaped by Brody, and Cameron was driving the boat. Witnesses say approximately 50 miles an hour up the lake when Reggie entered the water. So all three boys being impaired, perhaps Cameron, but we could hear laughing on the video, according to the Snapchat, people that saw the Snapchat. So Cameron either did not report immediately to Brody to go back, and Brody did not get back in time. And by the time they got back there, were going to be arguing to impairment. They could not find him. He had already started sinking to the bottom of the lake. This case is has been determined to be under maritime law. Lake Coeur d'Alene is a navigable body of water that navigates out to the sea, so it's considered to be under maritime law.
How would you navigate to the sea from Lake Coeur d'Alene?
Well,
it's a serious question. Sorry.
Yes, I know. It's set forth in the story how you navigate. I think that there may have subsequently been a dam put so that actual huge boats cannot navigate any longer, but it has been established to be a navigable body of water. And as I set forth in my briefing, it is still considered to be under maritime jurisdiction.
That's a very interesting argument given federal law that says it's not a navigable body of water. It's not a navigable body of water.
And again, Your Honor, I don't think that those issues were raised at the lower court level. That was not argued at the lower court level. However, that federal statute that was cited by Lynn in her briefing did not say that it is not a navigable body of water under maritime law. My understanding is that federal law just talked about certain types of docks and levees and things like that, but it didn't say that Lake Coeur d'Alene is no longer a navigable body of water.
Isn't the purpose of determining maritime law applicability in navigable bodies of water is to have a uniform jurisprudence as it relates to navigable bodies of water, which are bodies of water that border on states? Snake River, for instance, is a navigable body of water for purposes of maritime law. But I have a serious question as to whether Lake Coeur d'Alene is a navigable body of water for purposes of U.S. maritime law. And while I realize that maybe this wasn't argued before, I'm not certain that we want to, as a court, determine something that's wrong as a legal matter as a basis for this case to go forward. And that's the purpose of my question, is Lake Coeur d'Alene really a navigable body of water? I mean, it could have important ramifications going forward, not just for this case.
Yes. Well, the evidence that I have presented to the court in my briefing that I attached is all, I think the court can take judicial notice of all of that evidence, and previous decisions of the court have found it to be a navigable body of water. It is monitored by the U.S. Coast Guard, and it's still considered to be a federal navigable body of water, even though there may be a dam that is blocking that now. I know that was argued on appeal, although I don't think that any evidence was presented before the lower court. The only person that's presented evidence with regards to whether or not it's a navigable body of water and is still under federal maritime law, as the plaintiffs presented some evidence on appeal, because that issue was raised. However, I do think that there is a lot of case law that I cited to the court, and also, again, it is still considered to be a navigable body of water pursuant to the U.S. Coast Guard. So there were things that I attached that I think the courts can take judicial notice of because they're public record, and also case law that I cited in my brief that it's still considered to be a navigable body of water.
Is that an issue we have to decide in this case? Is that an issue we have to decide, whether it's navigable? I know the district court concluded that it was uncontroverted, that it was navigable.
It wasn't.
Which is consistent with our ruling in Stobie, but inconsistent with the statute that Justice Stegner is referring to.
Mm-hmm.
Is that an issue we have to determine in this decision?
I don't think it was properly raised before the lower court, so I don't think it's properly before the court. It can't be raised to the first time on appeal. So it was conceded, basically, that when we argued it in front of Judge Meyer, and nobody ever presented any evidence on that point to the contrary. I do think there's evidence to the contrary that I have submitted to this court. However, that's whether or not that's even properly in the record, because it wasn't argued below.
Is there a distinction between how this case would be decided if federal admiralty jurisdiction wasn't established?
Yes, I think that that's the main point here, is because the counsel is arguing that 23808 is applicable, and in maritime law, I think it's clearly not applicable. And we've cited quite a few cases with regards to why it's not applicable, because in maritime law, there's already just a general negligence standard that applies, and so you would... Tracy Lynn's part that she played in the death of Reginald Nault by providing these boys with large amounts of alcohol right before they embarked on the lake would be something that we would present evidence on as to how much negligence should be attributed to her.
Okay, so that goes back to my original question to you then, counsel, because deciding whether we need to figure this out or not, because certainly the path of least resistance is not to figure that out. But in this case, if the case was determined based upon a body of law that may not be applicable, doesn't that undermine the entire decision, even if it wasn't contested by the attorneys? I mean, this is a matter of jurisdictional nature. This case may have been decided under a body of law that it shouldn't have been.
Well, I'm
assuming
that
the arguments
that it was not erroneously considered to be a maritime case. And I, as I had set forth in my brief, I did state the reasons why it's still considered to be a federal navigable body of water. I know that that was argued, and we responded to that appropriately. I don't think it's properly before the court, as I stated in my brief, it's being argued for the first time on appeal. And I'm the only person that's presented any evidence to the contrary, so to show that it is still considered to be a federal navigable body of water.
If we get to the, or past this point, or bypass it, or just get to the meat of the question, though, isn't it really whether there's a uniform body of federal maritime law that provides ground shop liability? And the argument is, as I understand it, you say the Fifth Circuit cases hold sway, and that this should be, that there is no ground shop liability in the maritime law, and there's several cases, I think, that go the other way, and therefore it's not uniform, and therefore trial judge is correct. How do we get past that conclusion?
Well, I think that there's two things. First of all, we don't have to have a Dram Shop Act for there to just be a negligence, general duty, a violation of the duty causation and damages that we have generally in federal law. And all of the cases that I have cited support that we don't have to have a Dram Shop Act. Dram Shop is basically a anti-liability and provides proximate cause, but it takes away a remedy rather than adding a remedy. There already is a general remedy in federal law of just general negligence that was breached here. And 23808, as I had talked about in the Slade versus Smith decision that the Supreme Court of Idaho ruled on, they said there already is liability. It's whether or not we want to have the main focus be on the person that's providing alcohol rather than the person that's drinking the alcohol.
And I guess the question for me is whether state law, in this case, may supplement maritime law, where that law is silent, or there's a local matter of issue and so forth. Is it your position that maritime law is silent on gun shop liability, and therefore aren't going to get back to the point that state law should supplement that issue?
Number one, I don't think it's silent on dram shop liability. I think there are many cases that have been cited. In fact, I think only one case, the minor case, has been cited by respondents to support that there isn't a dram shop act, but I think that has been also borne out in my brief. There are many cases where they call these riverboat casinos, they call them floating dram shops, and those are all federal court cases. They talk about them being a dram shop. But there doesn't have to be necessarily a law that says we have dram shop liability. We have just general negligence. I also think it's overwhelmingly accepted. There are many, many cases that we have cited, and even more, if the court looks, where dram shop liability has been accepted at the federal court level. I don't know if there's one unpublished opinion in Northern California, and all the other cases are overwhelmingly in say that there is dram shop liability in federal at the federal level, whether that one case would say it's unsettled. I don't think there's several cases that I've seen. There's one case. I don't know what causes something to be settled. I've thought about that a lot on my way over here, but it doesn't have to be decided by the Supreme Court of the United States before it's settled. That I don't think so. I think when there's an overwhelming majority of federal courts that have acknowledge dram shop liability as an element of general negligence.
So if we accept your premise that there's several laws as far as dram shop liability under federal law and applying maritime jurisdiction, how does that square with the fact that you argued that Ms. Lynch is not a dram shop?
Ms. Lynn, yes. I don't think that dram shop is applicable, period, in any event. If the court thinks that we need to have a dram shop statute, which I'm saying we don't, because it's actually limiting liability, it's a proximate cause statute, we don't necessarily need to have a dram shop statute in order for there to be liability for negligence.
But counsel, didn't we decide that question in Fell versus Fat Smitty's, that you can't hide a dram shop case by just being under general negligence actions? If the facts pled are consistent with a dram shop case, doesn't that case hold that it is a dram shop case and decided under that statute?
Well, in the Fell versus Fat Smitty, they didn't do the 180-day notice requirement, and so they tried to frame it as a foreseeability issue rather than just as what it was a dram shop issue.
Well, they tried to frame it as a common negligence case and saying, we didn't plead dram shop, we pled negligence, and therefore the Dram Shop Act doesn't apply. That was their argument.
Right. I get that on the state level. That makes perfect sense. But at the federal level, we already have a general remedy in negligence, and the dram shop detracts from that, does not add to it. The state dram shop is not adding remedy at the federal level. So that's why Fell versus Fat Smitty does not apply in this certain circumstance, because you're trying to apply a state dram shop. The Supreme Court has said the dram shop is your only remedy in state court for a person that gets drunk and goes outside and stabs somebody, and the person that got stabbed wants to sue the bar. But what I'm saying is that we don't have to have that at the federal level, because we only use the State Dram Shop Act to the extent that it adds a remedy and it is detracting the remedy.
So, counsel, for that premise, are you relying on Yamaha case?
Well, I think the Yamaha case definitely says that.
That's my question. I don't see where the Yamaha case says that. So I see where the U.S. Supreme Court talks about the Moraine case, mm-hmm. and discusses that Moraine in some centered on the extension of relief, not on the contraction of remedies.
Right.
But then in the conclusion of Yamaha, the court says that Congress has not prescribed remedies for the wrongful deaths of non-seafarers in territorial waters. And then it goes on to say, it quotes DOSA, The provisions of any state statute giving or regulating rights of action or remedies for debt shall not be affected by this chapter. And then they say, taking into account that Congress sought to achieve and preserve the application of state statutes to debts within territorial waters. There's nothing in that holding that says only when they add to remedies, not when they detract. And so I'm wondering, where are you drawing that conclusion from in Yamaha?
Well, I'll just cite a couple of things that were in Yamaha, and there are a lot of things that Yamaha said, but two things specifically that Yamaha said was extending state wrongful death to fail accidents in territorial waters is compatible with substantive maritime policies. And then it goes on to say that Congress has indicated no concern about a disparity between adequate federal law and superior state benefits. So they will add benefit, like the wrongful death statute, if it adds on and adds a benefit to plaintiffs rather than detracting.
But is that dicta? Is the holding simply the statement, we preserve the application of state statutes to deaths within territorial waters?
Right, because that state wrongful death statute adds a remedy and does not detract a remedy.
But that's not in the holding.
A state benefit rather than a state detraction of
the law. But the holding doesn't talk about detracting or expanding.
I disagree. I think the holding talks about adding a remedy rather than detracting a remedy.
Okay.
So I do think that if you're in a riverboat, for example, and you're going in between state to state to state, and you've got one state on one side and another state on the other side, and you need to, as a riverboat captain, sit there and think, okay, well, what's the Dram Shop Act of this state on my right, or what's the Dram Shop Act of this state on my left? You want to have uniformity throughout. So you, in order to be following the law, you want to be following general federal uniform maritime law. And any state law that takes away from that is going to be detracting remedies that are available at federal maritime law where you lack uniformity.
So isn't the Young case, a federal case out of Texas, isn't that the case that better makes, more persuasively makes your point there?
Yeah, the Young case, absolutely. The Young case talks all about it and doesn't make my exact point that I'm trying to make. And there's many other cases that I've cited that are making that same point. I mean, the Reyes versus Vantage case, the Food versus Majestic. And I think, as was pointed out in my brief, the Lund case, the Meyer case that's been cited by respondents, she never argued that. She never argued general federal negligence law. She said that I want you to fashion a judicial Dram Shop Act, basically, is what her argument was. And they said, no, we're not going to do that. But at the same time, she never argued, you don't need to have a Dram Shop Act, and these Dram Shop Acts are deterring from my federal remedy, so they shouldn't be applied. I also would like to talk a little bit again about my Slay versus Smith argument, because I did note that in the Supreme Court decision regarding Slay versus Smith, I thought it was very interesting how they characterized 23808, and they talked a lot in Slay versus Smith about what the purpose is of 23808. And how we have a remedy. Slade talks about that a lot. There already is a remedy. You don't need to detract from a remedy that already exists. What happened within 23808 was that they wanted to say, we don't want to have these bars every single time somebody is getting intoxicated, getting sued, basically is what they're saying. But we're going to carve out a few circumstances wherein they can be sued. So, like serving to a knowingly intoxicated person and or knowingly serving to somebody who's underage. And what I wanted to talk about was this subsection 5, wherein the language kind of doesn't jar with the upper subsection 3. In this case, if the court does find that 23808 is applicable, which of course I'm arguing it's not, if they do find it's applicable, I think that the language within 23808 where in subsection 3 it says if serving to this person, if the person is underage, if the intoxicated person is underage, and then under section 5 it specifically says you have to give notification if you sold to an intoxicated person. So because of that and the way that they t- talked about 23808 in the Slade case in certain part where I had cited. It seems to me that you only have to give 180-day notice to people who are serving alcohol to an obviously intoxicated person and not to somebody who knowingly serves alcohol to minors. Just the way that it's worded in there, it really seems that that's what it's referring to, and I think that that is also borne out in the Slade dicta. It's dicta, but they do talk quite a bit about that 23808 is not adding a remedy. It's taking away a remedy. And then limiting it to certain circumstances, and then making it even smaller because we're basically making a statute of limitations upon which time you can discover who the defendant is. So,
we've been discussing 23808 in terms of the notice requirement, which kind of resembles the Tort Claims Act in some ways. Isn't the bigger concern here, though, Section 4 of 23808, which limits the ability of an intoxicated person or their estate to even bring an action that would touch on the Dram Shop Act? Isn't that really, if there is a fatal flaw to your case, wouldn't it be 23808-4?
I can see your point. However, there's a couple of different arguments there. Number one, Reggie was not the only intoxicated person. There were three intoxicated people. So,
but they're not bringing suit. It's Reggie and his estate that are bringing suit.
And again, this is a minor child, and I do think that there's within the statute, an exception carved out for people that are suing on behalf of minor children.
Could you point us to that in the statute?
Well, just in the way that it talks about the intoxicated person, like, you know, you're serving to someone that you already know to be intoxicated.
So you're suggesting it's implicit in the statute, it doesn't apply to minors?
Well, I'm just saying that in the statute it seems to make a little exception for minors with regards to the way it words the intoxicated person. So I don't know the exact answer to what you're saying, but what I'm trying to say is that there were three people that were intoxicated and all three people were the cause of the death together, not just the impairment of Reginald Knoll. If the reason why he passed away was that he was intoxicated, we still have two other intoxicated people, and I'm not arguing that he passed away because he was intoxicated. I'm arguing that he passed away because the other two boys were intoxicated.
But the respondent in this case, the defendant in this case is Lynn, the supposed dram shop owner, not the two other intoxicated boys' parents or them.
Right, the defendant is Lynn, but what I'm saying is the causation. If you think about 23808, we're trying to limit an intoxicated person from suing because they caused their own damage by becoming intoxicated, so to speak. But what I'm saying is she gave the derailleur to all three people, so it could be argued that Reggie did not die because he was intoxicated. He died because Cameron and Brody were intoxicated. That's what I'm trying to say.
So how did you plead your complaint? Did you plead it as Lynn was at fault because Reggie was intoxicated, or Lynn was at fault because the other two were intoxicated?
I don't have that right in front of me, but the complaint was basically that all three boys were intoxicated and that led to Reggie's death. I don't think necessarily that Reggie went into the lake because he was intoxicated. He may have fallen into the lake because he was intoxicated. However, it was a combination of all three people being intoxicated and impaired, and the spotter, like I said, and the driver, like I said. So Reggie wasn't the only allegedly impaired person.
So how would we instruct the jury on this case if we send it back, that we can find Lynn responsible for the alcohol that she provided to the two boys that were the spotter and the driver, but she can't be held responsible for the alcohol that was provided to Reggie? I'm just trying to understand it.
I think that that's going to be a jury instruction and a causation issue that can be argued at the court below, but I don't think that's necessarily an issue for summary judgment. So I
think that it's a perfect storm of all three people having been drinking and likely over the legal limit for minors.
I'm reluctant for them to send cases back without giving instructions on how to parse those issues. And so, humor me. How do we tell the jury what you're suggesting?
If that's what the ruling ends up being of the Supreme Court,
well, that's what you're asking us to do.
Pardon me?
That seems to be what you're asking us to do.
Yeah, if that ends up being what the ruling is of the Supreme Court, then I think that you could make the limiting instruction saying you're only to consider whether the impairment of Brody and Cameron was caused the death of Reginald Knopf and to what extent it caused the death of Reginald Knopf.
And does their negligence then have to exceed that of Reggie for recovery to be had?
I don't think so under maritime law, because we have pure comparative fault under maritime law. So that would we wouldn't necessarily have that comparative fault statute applicable. But that issue has not been argued. That's, I think, an issue for another day. But my understanding is that at maritime law, we have pure comparative fault, and we don't compare their negligence to Reggie's.
What's the authority for suggesting that federal maritime law under these circumstances would be pure comparative?
I don't have any authority today for that. I have researched the issue. I don't have it in front of me, Your Honor. I'm sorry. But it's my understanding that it is pure comparative fault, and I have researched the issue in the past. I just did not research it recently for pursuing it today. Oh, thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honor, Counsel, and please the court. First of all, as a matter of housekeeping, thank you for bringing the court to Northern Idaho. I hope your stay up north is and the residents of Coeur d'Alene are treating you well. My name is Dan Stella. I obviously represent the defendant, Tracy Lynn. We believe that the trial court, Judge Cynthia Meyer, made the correct decision when she found, as a matter of law, that plaintiff's claims were barred because she failed to provide pre-suit notices required by Idaho's so-called Dram Shop Act, Idaho Code Section 23808 sub 5, which was really the only basis of the court's decision for dismissing on summary judgment. And Your Honor, I think counsel's argument today makes it perfectly clear, at least it did to me, and hopefully it does to the court, that the basis of plaintiff's appeal is primarily asking this court to make a couple decisions, primarily to provide a remedy where state law otherwise would not allow it. The issues presented for purposes of today's appeal ask this court to make a choice between following Idaho law or disregarding it in favor of applying federal maritime law. The issues on appeal in this case ask this court to make a choice between following Idaho law or legislating from the bench, frankly, and rewriting Idaho's Dram Shop Act. Again, we think the trial court did the correct thing in 2018 when she made her decision on summary judgment and granting summary judgment, when she applied Idaho law and dismissed plaintiff's claims.
To what extent has your client acquiesced in maritime law applying in this case at all?
We haven't, Your Honor, and we did defer to other defendants to make the maritime argument more vigorously than we did, frankly, at the trial court level. But what we did and what the trial court did was, in our analysis, we looked at the body of maritime law and decided we don't really need to fight that fight, Your Honor, because I think as a matter of maritime law, there is no federal overarching standard. There's no preemption of the field as it relates to dram shop applicability. So based upon the lessons that we've learned by way of Wilburn Boat, the Supreme Court decision from 1955, when there is no federal preemption, when there is no standard across the board, when there is no congressional preemption of the field, then it's a matter of state law. That's what Wilburn Boat teaches us. And to the extent the council relies on other maritime cases that are not from the Ninth Circuit, but are from other jurisdictions, unanimously or consistently across those cases relied upon by plaintiff, those cases do not even reference Wilburn Boat. And that's the criticism that Judge Meyer found in her opinion as well, in a memorandum opinion, was that that's all well and good, but those are basically decisions made by other courts in other jurisdictions, primarily with a goal of finding a remedy or sidestepping maritime law or applying maritime law when it's convenient to get to a certain result. In this particular case, we think the better course of action is to follow the Supreme Court's guidance in Wilburn Boat, apply state law when there is no federal overarching principle or legal basis for applying maritime law. So the fallback then is to apply state law. And that's the lesson of Wilburn Boat. That's ultimately what the trial court did, and that's ultimately why we didn't put too much argument or too much effort into arguing the maritime applicability or the non-applicability, as it were, because we thought that ultimately, even if we did apply maritime law or start down that road, the overarching principles that apply, even when we go down that path, lead us back to the state statute. So to answer your question, Your Honor, we didn't punt as it related to the issue at the trial court level. We just thought that our efforts could be spent elsewhere with greater effect. And so to that extent, Your Honor, that's the condition of the argument at the trial court level. And getting to counsel's point with respect to us now raising that decision, the decision to apply maritime law at the trial court level as an error for purposes of appeal, that's entirely consistent, in my view, as based upon the appellate rules 15A. We don't have to file a separate appeal on that particular issue. We just have to raise it because I think it's germane for purposes of this overall appeal.
So, counsel, on the issue of the navigability, as I read your summary judgment briefing, you deferred to one of the noteworthy defendants' briefing. Do we have that briefing in the record?
I believe I caught that, Your Honor, and I believe I did it by way of augmented record, and I'm not finding the specific reference to that, but I believe that we did note that that was omitted in the original transmittal of the record to the court, and it was my understanding or my intention that that be supplemented as well. So if it's not in the record, that's entirely my oversight, Your Honor, and I apologize for that.
So, Mr. Stowe, you talked about us legislating from the bench. As I understand, Ms. Gordon-Daniel, she's asking us to stop your client from the applicability of the 180-day notice because Ms. Lynn lied to the police. Would you like to respond to that argument?
Well, there's no way around it, Your Honor. This is a tragic set of circumstances all around.
No doubt.
And the response to that, Your Honor, I would say, was addressed by Judge Meyer as well. And those are the equitable arguments.
She found that the statute was kind of on its face and that she didn't have the ability to accept Ms. Lynn from the applicability of the 180-day notice.
Exactly, Your Honor. So the court and the record, I think it's at 420, the trial court references the equitable arguments or the unclean hands argument the plaintiff was raising. And basically the trial court, Judge Meyer, indicated in her memorandum of opinion at that time that the unclean hands doctrine was inapplicable. Because
that's a legal question, isn't it?
Say again?
That's a legal question, isn't it? Whether the unclean hands doctrine applies?
I think it is a legal question, and I think that the trial court was correct in her analysis of that argument.
But our review of that determination is de novo.
I understand that, Your Honor, and I would respectfully submit that the trial court was correct with that particular portion of her decision, that the equitable arguments that the plaintiff makes are certainly not of any consideration. There's nothing in the statute that says we've got, you know, subsections 1 through 5, but none of this will apply if you've got equitable arguments against it. So to the extent that Judge Meyer determined that we were raising an unambiguous statutory bar, which precluded any application of equitable doctrines, I think she was absolutely correct, and I would encourage the court to follow that decision.
You wouldn't be able to suggest that Ms. Lynn has clean hands, would you?
No, Your Honor, based upon the record, that'd be foolish of me to make that argument. But from the standpoint, and it hasn't been addressed yet, was that precisely the relief that 23808 provides. It provides relief to both dram shops, commercial furnishers of alcohol, as well as social hosts. Counsel, in her briefing, likes to further limit the plain statutory language by requiring social hosts to only be having parties, wine parties, at their residence. That's not what the statute says. And I think that this court, in the Felby Fats Mitty's case, indicated that the legislature certainly could have, had it wanted to, could have further defined those various categories. From our standpoint, we've got a commercial furnisher of alcohol, dram shop, not applicable to my client, but certainly for purposes of application of the statute, she was a social host, a non-commercial entity, who is alleged to have furnished alcohol under these circumstances. So, based upon the Felby Fats Mitty's case, Your Honor, we respectfully submit that the trial court did the correct thing in dismissing this case, even though she didn't obviously have the benefit of the case. But her opinion and her decision is certainly consistent with the decision by this court in July of last year. The court in Felby Fats Mitty's indicated that the counsel has again tried to get around the plain facts of the case, but getting to Justice Zahn's question about how the case was pled, it was clearly a negligence claim based upon furnishing alcohol. That's what the complaint is about, and it's replete with references to intoxication. It's replete with references to furnishing alcohol. Even though there might be an attempt at this stage to be a little bit more creative with respect to causes of action or pleadings, the facts remain the same. And the facts of our case apply Felby Fats Mitty's, compel application of the Dram Shop Act to our facts, and compel a decision by this court, we feel, respectfully, that because the 180-day pre-suit notice had not been complied with in this particular case, that serves as a basis for dismissal. Now, that is the basis of dismissal in this case. Hypothetically, had pre-suit notice been given, that would bring us away from subsection 5, but take us to subsection 4, which would have precluded the claims that they're trying to bring anyway.
It wouldn't preclude the claims against Cameron and Brody, would it? I mean, the vicarious claims of Lynn providing alcohol to Cameron and Brody?
I think you're right.
Let's assume that Reggie didn't have a 0.18 or whatever it was alcohol content, right, and had a 0.00 blood alcohol content. Would Ms. Jones be able to sue Ms. Lynn for the alcohol that was provided to Cameron and Brady under the circumstances?
So if I understand yours hypothetical, so we're not presuming that Reggie was not intoxicated?
Correct.
Okay. And would that preclude a claim against my client?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I believe so, Your Honor.
Against the alcohol that was provided to the driver and the spotter. Let's say they were drunk, and the alcohol that was provided them was wounded them is what intoxicated them. And let's also assume that Ms. Lynn knew that they were intoxicated when she provided it. Would Does Yamaha have a cause of action against those two boys?
Gosh, I think, if I'm following Your Honor's hypothetical, I think the touchstones that 2308 provide us are whether or not there's been an allegation of furnishing alcohol. And I think under your hypothetical, yes, there still is. And then secondarily is the person who was, now under your hypothetical, no longer intoxicated, would they be able to, would that individual or their estate be able to file a claim or present a claim against those other individuals?
Or against those who are providing alcohol to them. I think 2308 clearly is the applicable statutory provision because it doesn't afford immunity to the spotter or the driver that Ms. Jones could sue them.
Gosh. I haven't gone through those mental gymnastics, Your Honor, and I'm not frankly prepared to do that today, but I think the statutes still would provide immunity under those circumstances or non-liability under those circumstances.
And that's why.
Then I guess if Reg is no longer intoxicated, then they're obviously changing the facts of this case. And, you know, as I'm looking at subsection 4A, maybe that would allow a cause of action under those facts. So I apologize, Your Honor. I wasn't prepared to address that hypothetical as plainly as I would have liked.
Not too good words, I mean, so.
Got me a little bit off guard, I thought.
I think I thought it was long enough there, too, so...
Turn them out of spare play. I keep doing this, and it's not effective with the mask on. All right, so... the issues that we wanted to address, obviously, for purposes of today's argument, were Phelps v. Pasadena, and I think we've done that. The Dram Shop Act, and what I would like to highlight in a little bit more depth is that, again, we've touched on it in a little bit of detail, but subsection 1 obviously triggers application of the act when there's furnishing alcohol, and the legislature has decided that that is not a proximate cause of injuries inflicted by intoxicated persons. And I think that's important for purposes of the summary judgment below and this appeal today, because obviously proximate cause is an element of negligence. So to the extent that furnishing alcohol is not a proximate cause, that would then serve as a basis of dismissal, which it ultimately did. And we'll talk about subsections 4 and 5. It's clear, obviously, that in this particular case, there was no 180-day pre-suit notice as required under subsection 5. We would respectfully submit that the trial court's decision be upheld as a result. As it relates to, I've got 13 minutes or thereabouts, enough time, frankly, for me to talk about applicability or inapplicability of maritime law as it relates to these facts. Again, we would respectfully submit, even though it wasn't vigorously raised at the trial court level, we would respectfully submit that maritime law should not have been applied in this particular case based upon the premise that navigable waters be kind of the linchpin that at least initiates application of maritime law. And by virtue of the definitions that we've provided in our materials, in our opening brief at 7 and 8, we've cited to 33 CFR 329.4 with respect to the definition of navigable waters of the U.S. And just in summary, navigable waters are defined as those waters that are subject to the ebb and flow of the tide, which I guess from a physics standpoint, any body of water, a cup of water, is infinitesimally affected by the ebb and flow of tide, so-called, just by virtue of the moon, I suppose, but it's not in the record. But at least for purposes of the definitions, we don't think that Lake Coeur d'Alene is a navigable body of water. That's certainly supported by 33 U.S. Code Annotated Section 59M, as in Mike, passed in 1976. It does deal with obstruction of navigable waters. And in that particular code section, it declares that Lake Coeur d'Alene is non-navigable. I cited to those federal statutes because they are also consistent with the Ninth Circuit opinion of Adams versus Montana Power, which states that a cause of action sounding in court is not cognizable under admiralty jurisdiction unless the alleged wrong occurs on navigable waters, which we think that didn't happen in this case, and bears a significant relationship to traditional maritime activity. There's nothing in the undisputed facts of this case that would trigger traditional maritime activity. Recreational boating, it isn't an interstate commerce type of activity. And Adams addresses that further by stating, and this is at page 9 of our materials, that no purpose is served by application of maritime law on waters devoid of trade and commerce to regulate the activities and resolve the disputes of pleasure boaters. Only the burdening of federal courts, in this case the state court, and the frustrating of the purposes of state tort law would be thereby served. So, without mistake, that is what the plaintiff is asking this court to do in this particular case, is to apply an overarching general negligence under the rubric of alleged maritime applicability in support of frustrating, sidestepping, avoiding, disregarding Idaho's plain language with respect to the Dram Shop Act. So it's entirely inconsistent with the Ninth Circuit opinion of Adams versus Montana Power. We talked previously a little bit about the Wilburn Boat analysis, and that was a dispute between parties on an artificial lake between Texas and Oklahoma. In that particular case, maritime insurance contracts were at issue, and the Supreme Court found that there wasn't an overarching federal maritime body of law. In that case, they deferred back to the state law, which the court in that case said that we, like Congress, leave regulation of marine insurance where it has been with the states. The same lessons apply equally, we feel, to this case, that the regulation of Dram Shop Act or finishing alcohol to intoxicated persons within the state of Idaho should be left to an application and a construction of the Idaho Dram Shop Act. So that's why we feel that the lessons of Wilburn Boat apply equally to the facts of this appeal. Absent a clear federal preemption of the field, we think that regulation should be left to the states. So, with that, Your Honors, unless there are any additional questions, we would respectfully submit that the trial court made the correct decision below, notwithstanding its application of maritime law, but ultimately, in the end, we got back to application of the Idaho Dram Shop Act and exclusion or dismissal of plaintiff's cases as a matter of law. And we would respectfully submit that that was the correct decision below and should be affirmed by this court. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, sir. Madam Clerk, how much time remains for the appeal?
1 minute, Your Honor.
Ma'am?
I am going to use my 1 minute because an interesting point was brought up by Your Honors. And basically, to call Tracy Lynn a social host, I think would be a huge stretch of the word social host. She's more kind of like a drug dealer. She's doing something she knows is illegal. She's not having a party at her house where children are maybe there and may have partaken of some alcohol unknowingly or something like that.
She is more like a guy that stands outside the liquor store and says, hey, children, can I buy you some alcohol? And you can pay me $10 and I'll go in and get you some alcohol. I mean, that's her type of behavior. It was very clandestine and hidden. And in addition to that, she lied to the police. So I don't think that it's just that she spoliated evidence by lying to the police. It's the clandestine nature of the legal thing that she was doing that caused plaintiffs to not know her name in a timely manner.
So, counsel, is there anything in the record that tells us when your clients learned there is any evidence to indicate that Ms. Lynn had provided this alcohol?
I think that it didn't come out until a police report was released. So a police report was released, but it did not come out until much later after that, even her name. So we did not have her name because we didn't even have a police report yet.
And when was the police report released?
Well, a year later, much later, we were at working with the police, and we were working with the police, and they said, if we find out who gave these boys alcohol, we're going to let you know right away. I mean, that we were on the case from day one. The police were allegedly investigating it. They did not have any evidence at that time that she had furnished the alcohol, and only because when she called them, we learned later, she flat lied.
And so you're saying your clients learned that when they got the police report?
They learned about it, yes, when they
got it. And is that date in the record?
I don't think that date is in the record.
Okay, thank you.
In the record before you, I don't think it is.
Okay.
I'd have to be stretching back in my memory about that, though. But I do know it was after a year. Thank you.
Very well, ma'am. Thank you very much. And thank you to both counsels for your fine notes and briefing and arguing this case. The matter is under advisement and decision on the issue. Normally, we would come down and shake your hands and maybe on the fine notes. So we'll see that from this distance today. And please thank you for your fine note today. That will be in recess until tomorrow at 8:50.
All right.